What if we started right away with it? What if we just knocked it out? Welcome to Fated Mates.
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. And we should introduce ourselves and our voices.
We should do it real professional.
Too late, Sarah.
Welcome, everybody, to Fated Mates. Wait, that's not professional. That's different like kind of professional.
Also good. Welcome to Fated Mates, everybody. I'm Jen Reed's Romance, joined by my, I don't know, my partner in crime.
Trusty cohort.
Yes, there you go.
Noble steed, Sarah McLean.
There you go.
I write romances and I read romances.
I critique romances and also appear at local bookstores talking about romance.
Appear at local. I mean, I do that too. What is that?
Sure. I don't know. Here's the part. You talk about your own books. I talk about other people's books. Here's the best part. So I was at this bookstore last night and I was with these other three amazing critics. Diego Baez, Walton Mumbaya, I'm not sure I'm saying his name correctly, and then Liz Taylor.
Oh, from the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, she's amazing.
I know Elizabeth Taylor from the Chicago Tribune because a million years ago when I was a publicist, I used to pitch her stories.
Oh.
And I always thought, I mean, like, that's a name you don't forget.
She wrote a great book about Mayor Daley. If you're at all interested in, like, books about cities, it's called American Pharaoh, and it's amazing. But anyway, at the end, I'm, like, passing out Fated Mate stickers and buttons.
Welcome, new readers.
And I was totally, like,
who love biographies of Mayor Daley and also romance novels.
Yeah, and both Walton and Diego were like, we don't have stickers. And I was like, that's okay. Here, would you like one? And then Walton said he would listen to our podcast. And I was like...
Well, let's make it a good one then.
I know. I'm like the pressure I felt now feel under. It was amazing. That was really fun. So we are going to talk about a book that blooded you this week, Sarah.
We are. So for those of you just joining us, because I have a feeling that it feels like if Beverly is happy with this, she'll probably post it to her group and we might get some new listeners. So,
oh, yeah.
To people who are just joining us because of the book we're reading this week, this season, this is our second season of Fated Mates. Our first season followed the Cressley Cole Immortals After Dark paranormal series, and we truly believe that it would only be 20 episodes long. And we would just do one episode for every book in that series, and then that would be that, and we would all go back to our normal lives. But we really like talking into everybody's ear holes, and so we ended up doing lots of what we call interstitial episodes, where we talked about just books we love, the tropes that we love, and why they work, and we recommend a lot of books, and TBR piles across America and the world groan under the weight of our recommendations. And then when we got to the end of Immortals After Dark, we decided to do a season two, and we decided to do the books that blooded us, by which we mean the books that taught us why romance is amazing, what romance can be as a genre, and what the books themselves can do, how they can really take the cake,
yeah,
so to speak. So Jen and I, at the beginning of this season, each made a list of 10 books we really loved. And then we compared notes, and we have a little bit of overlap. But this book, Beverly Jenkins's Indigo, was probably first two or three books that I put on the list. And I love this book for so many reasons. And I really honestly, Jen, feeling like I felt like on this reread, having Fated Mates in my mind always.
Right.
I had a completely eye-opening read of it, which is kind of remarkable because I've read it probably 100 times. So, yeah. So I'm really grateful that we're doing this because it felt like, I mean, now I know Beverly and I feel like it's just a whole new world reading it.
Now, this is my first time reading it, but I do like the, like, when's the first time you read it story? You don't have to go into, like, great detail.
No, I think this one's important, too. This is, and so I grew up, I've talked about this before, I grew up in a suburb of Providence in Rhode Island, kind of between, everything is a suburb of Providence in Rhode Island, but it's just in a town called Lincoln, just south of the Massachusetts border, and it's a real white town. there was one black kid in my high school.
Yeah.
And it was a real, real white town. And the high school shared a parking lot with the public library. And I've told this story before, but I came to romance really through that public library. My sister read them, but then she went to college. And so I had to get my fix in a different way. And I did that at the library. And I read, you know, all of the Fabio books and all of the Judith McNaught books. And I mean, when you're a kid who's reading romance novels voraciously and, you know, your mom isn't taking you to the bookstore and you don't have any, like, I didn't have an allowance. I didn't have, like, I mean, maybe I had an allowance, but I sure didn't have an allowance that would cover my book budget.
I still don't.
And my mom was like, you can read these books, but I'm not buying you a book. I'm not spending, like, hundreds of dollars a week so you can read a book in 2 hours, right?
That is literally what libraries are for, bless.
Yeah. So, like, I would leave high school. So there was I remember there was the release bus from, you know, it was, this book came out in 1995. So I would have been a junior. And there was the normal bus that went home at like whatever, 2:20. And then there was the, like, the 3:15 bus that would go. And it was like for quick after school stuff. So I would skip the 2:20 bus, go to the library and like load up on romance novels and then take the 3:15 bus home. And, I read every book that was in the romance section of that library. But I found Indigo. I mean, I found Indigo. I was a junior in high school. It must have been just out. And it was probably in the new romance section. So bless to the Lincoln Public Library for making sure that Indigo was in the new romance section. And I was transformed. Yeah. I mean, like, and at this point, I've been reading romance for at least 4 or 5 years, at least three or four years, probably 4 years.
Right.
And it was the first romance novel, historical romance novel I had ever read or come across about black characters. Of course, now I know that there's a reason for that. And that reason is that no one had ever done it before. Bev was the first black romance writer to write historical romances about black characters. And I, but I'm not sure that registered to me.
Interesting. Okay.
I don't, now, of course, when I tell the story, I'm like, oh, it must have registered to me, but I don't think it did. But what did register to me about this book and what made me a Beverly Jenkins fan, because I then read after, I mean, I've read all of Bev's work.
Yeah.
Is Hester. I mean, of course.
Yeah.
Anybody who knows, like, Sarah McLean and, like, anybody who's been following my, like, Books That Blooded Me list, like, knows Hester would ring a bell for me.
Sure.
And then also, for me, this I do think I registered. It was the first time I had ever seen slavery on the page, or the sort of America in slavery on the page, and had it be about characters and people and identities rather than a kind of cold analysis of history.
Sure, sure.
And that, to 16-year-old me, was transformational. And I think it is possible that this book is the first romance I ever read where I had that kind of seed of an idea that sort of germinated that seed of romance is doing something bigger. That was a long story. I know you said, don't tell me a long story, but like that's...
No. I think that's why it's important, because sometimes the books, right? Sometimes the books just like emotionally speak to you, but sometimes you really are like, no, like that book really, like it was like a marking point, right? There was like before you and after you.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, we talk all the time about, I mean, I joke about how my SAT scores were, my SAT verbal was perfect. And it was because of romance novels, right? Like I knew all the kings of England because of romance novels. Like we learn, romance readers intuitively know, like we're learning so much when we're reading empirically.
Yeah.
But what Bev taught me with Indigo and with Night Song and the other, which that's her second book and I adore it. But with all these books, like suddenly this period of American history became vibrant and real.
Yeah.
And that's because my white high school teachers didn't know how to do it.
It's however many years later and people still don't know how to do it.
Yeah,
right?
They didn't know how to make slavery, how to teach slavery. Because it's, we've talked about this before too, like abhorrent things are hard to, it's hard to wrap your head around them and do it justice. And also, I mean, it's a challenge. It's, as Laquette would say, it is uncomfortable. And like discomfort is where we have to learn. But
yeah, the thing I, as a teacher, say, and if I've said this before, like, Eric, you can cut this, but I don't know if I have. So I struggle a little with, like, the way, like, we say that about slavery, because all my students know what the Holocaust is. They all know, they all come into school, like, knowing, having, like, you know, into seventh grade, having, like, a basic knowledge of that. But they don't know anything about slavery, and they don't know anything about lynching. And I noodle around a lot with the idea that it's because in the Holocaust, we're the good guys, right? Even though that's not true, right?
Because you have to face your own, like, evil.
Evil, facing what your country has done. And what it's still doing, I think, is a really big part of that. You know what I mean? And so it's not, and it's, what's really interesting, when Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead came out a couple of years ago, I was in a Goodreads group where someone was talking about the first chapter, which is just like really unflinching about the violence that slaves were subjected to. And one of the people in the group was just like, I just thought it was like too much. And someone really was like, yeah, but that's how it was. Like, and the person was like, come on, really? And this person was like, we live in a country where people used to like gather on the town square to watch lynchings and then sell postcards. And this person really did have to kind of have this like moment where they're like, oh my God, I have been sold the, instead of being, I've been sold the Gone with the Wind slavery narrative, right? All of literature sells the, it wasn't really that bad narrative.
Well, and let's also not discount the fact that the country itself is so segregated still.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, I was a white kid growing up in a white town in a, like, all-white school but for one.
Yeah.
And so, like, this narrative, also in the North.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course.
So, like, where, of course, we had nothing to do with it, quote.
Right.
Right? Like, that's me being facetious, but, like,
only the South is racist.
Right. Like, when Northerners aren't racist, except, like, of course, that's nonsense. Like, but these are hard questions that are, I mean, I do think schools are doing it better. I will say this. I also grew up in Rhode Island, which is heavily Catholic. We had one Jewish kid in our school, too. And she was the reason why I knew about the Holocaust. Like, I do think, like, there are, I think this is about, I think atrocities perpetuated by Christians and white people tend to be,
they just get swept under,
I get it. Like, that's hard parenting to do, to say, like, we did this. Our ancestors did this. We're perpetuating this.
Yeah.
And, like, I think we're doing it better now, but yeah, I did not have the same experience about the Holocaust. Like, that also was a...
new to you, yeah.
I mean, but I don't know. But that was also 1995.
It's also hard to, like, go back to a time when you didn't know things. I guess I would say... So, here's... When I don't want to, like, necessarily totally derail this conversation, although it's an interesting one. I have read Beverly Jenkins, like, latest books, but I've not read Indigo, and I've not read any of the Levesque clan, which I'm now like, tee these
heads. They're so good. Because all the books that come after this are Hester and Galen's children.
Oh, God. I mean, and that's, I will tell you, and I know I've said this before, but in my book club and 57th Street books, a woman once pointed out that, like, the heroes and heroines of her contemporaries are, like, the ancestors of her.
I love that so much.
Oh, God, it's amazing. But this book, I will say, so I started reading it. I guess a brief plot overview, right? Like, Hester is living in Michigan on her own. She's a young woman. She's in, her aunt has recently been deceased. She was born into slavery from in a rather remarkable story about her father was free and essentially sells himself into slavery to be with the woman he loves.
So can I interrupt you for just 1 second to say, and I'm going to let you, because this is new, it's a new book to you, so I want you to like lead. But that is a true story that Bev came to when she was doing the research for Indigo. She read an autobiography, and the line was, I once knew a man who sold himself into slavery for love.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she also said the letters that she wrote, the letters that begin the book, came to her like in like a fugue state. Like she just, they poured out of her, like the people were speaking through her.
Oh my God, my whole body. I just got the shivers. It's so amazing. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I feel like that's like the most, not unbelievable because racism, but, you know, we do have now, especially with the internet, and I will put tons of information in show notes, like actual links to like letters that slaves wrote back and forth. And, you know, even though it was illegal for them to read, like people who did know how to read and, or who had people write for them. And, you know, we have so much more information that stories like this are, we're going to hear more and more. Mm-hmm. And I think there's lots of really great American novels that deal with this. I actually went back this week and reread parts of a book from the early 80s called The Cheneysville Incident by, I think the guy's name is David Bradley. Yes. And he wrote a novel about a man in the middle of Pennsylvania trying to figure out what happened to his ancestors who were trying to save slaves. And so this whole time period, I think there's actually lots and lots of books that were written about it. But this book is just magnificent. I've got to tell you, Sarah, it was like electric. I mean, I want to tell everybody, I will sit down with the book and read it straight through, and I put down this book like probably 5 or 6 times. Like I would literally get to a chapter and was like, I'm going to close it now because I just want to, I want to like have that anticipation.
It's really delicious.
Oh,
it's
God.
It's great. And I think that's the magic of it is like, it feels like. It's just, I mean, it's a perfect. So right from the very start, from that first page, right, where there's the bang on the floor, like in the, like she just, it's a debut. How is this a debut? We were texting the other day, Jen and I, and I was saying like, we're talking about, I don't know, some book. And I was like, look, you know, and Jen, of course, is always more critical than I am.
It's my job, Sarah.
And so she was being critical and I was like, it's a debut. Like debuts are messy. Like my debut is 127,000 words and it should be 100,000 words. Like they're messy and often they're flabby and there are mistakes in them. And like, that is not to say that I'm sure there are, you know, things Bev would change about this book, but like it's a debut and it starts in the exact
right place.
And it sets the scene in an exact right way. Well, actually, it's not her first book. For some reason, I thought it was her first book. But Night Song is her first book, which I also adore. And that came out in 1994. Indigo was definitely the first of Bev's books that I read, though. And then I think I immediately, it was one of those situations where, like, it came out in 1996. I just checked the date. So actually, and then there was Night Song and then Vivid and then Indigo. But Indigo was first. And I mean, and I think when people talk about Bev, this is one of those situations where like, this is the book they talk about. You hear about Indigo a lot.
Right. Right.
And now we know why.
Yeah. So. Oh, it's amazing. Well, and it's just one of those things too. I mean, it's, you know, we can't keep them all straight. It was a long time ago.
It's true, but I mean, it's for me, this was my, you know, this was my first and I've loved her ever since. And she tells this magnificent story in these like really remarkable, she makes really interesting choices about who she's telling the story about. I want to talk about the fact that like we see Hester so much more than we see Galen.
Yeah.
Like there's so much interesting stuff packed in here and I find it. Like, it's just a great, great read.
Oh, God,
yes. And I mean, in the years since, I have read every Beverly Jenkins book, and there are other magnificent reads in the canon of Jenkins. Right. But like this will always be. Hester is, she's like sort of in the pantheon of heroines for me.
She essentially is a conductor on what is essentially the Underground Railroad through Michigan. And this is in the 1850s. So it's the fugitive slave law is in effect. And this was like a really interesting and terrible time in America's history in this like lead up to the Civil War, because, you know, up until this point, Northerners could just sort of essentially like pretend, okay, yeah, slavery was bad, but it was happening somewhere else. And now slavery is something that everyone has to help enforce. And so, and the danger with these slave catchers, I mean, all of this, by the way, and I kind of hate that she has to like show her work in a bibliography at the end, but you know, the business about.
She does that in like almost every one of her books.
Well, because people are going to question her and that's terrible, but it's useful.
Nobody
in case
does
you want
research
more.
Like Bev Jenkins does research.
And the whole part about like $10 if you send a slave back and $5 if you acquit them, all of that is true. Mm. And so when what happens is Hester is essentially caring for a man in her basement who has been badly beaten but has gotten away from slave catchers. And she finds out that who he is sort of like one of the most infamous and famous brave men sort of ferrying slaves to safety in the North, the Black Daniel. And, you know, he's rude and terrible, but they are in close quarters together and she's taking care of him. And it is, oh God, Sarah.
It's really great.
One of the brilliant things about this book is she's like innocent, right? She's like young and a virgin and all that business, but there is nothing missish about her, to use like sort of a
no
right
way.
Like she knows herself and she knows what she wants and she is determined like on the road to help people and be a part of her community, and she's not putting up with the dude who thinks women shouldn't be part of it, and she's not putting up with this Black Daniel telling her that she can't. I mean, I just, from the very beginning, she is this amazing, like, kind of fully formed character. Like, if Beverly Jenkins was Zeus and Hester's, like, Athena, like, popping out of his head, that's how it feels.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a fabulous story, in large part because there's also a certain amount of, there's a really remarkable amount of DNA here, like his romance DNA in here. Like, this is an adventure story. Like, you are dropped into this story.
Yes.
Like she, when, so there's this knock on the floor, she opens the hatch in the floor and there's a family of slaves there with a person, like another conductor who's led them to safety in her house. There's, you know, wounded Daniel Galen, and then there's this sort of instant sense of like, oh shit, like we're like it's life or death, literally. And, like, here we are. Like, there are going to be good guys. There are going to be bad guys. Like, it's a very sort of, like, it's, there is a sort of binariness about this story in that it is good versus evil. And so the adventure is so palpable because it can't not be. They're constantly thinking about, like, how to do this. But at the same time, we don't see the adventure.
Like
the extra, it's so, she's closed the doors that so much that you end up feeling like this adventure is happening and they're part of it. But what's really important is this sort of love story.
Well, and also I think that it's like the human connections that they're making. It's an adventure and the risks are worth it because of what it means to Hester and her community and for freedom. So it's like all the human connections are what are prioritized rather than, you know, like the drama. And that's true kind of throughout, like from beginning to end. I mean, and so, you know, everything about anything that's like kind of adventure-y is like toned down so that it can be about people's feelings first. And I think it's just this really remarkable and very wise choice, because then the ways that Bev shows like the sacrifices that people are making, both personally and politically, like everything has weight, And some of it is just like, there's this one part, and I don't know if this struck you again, but like, she's feeding him, right? Like, and he's recovering and he's really hungry and he's a big man. And she keeps saying that she's not hungry, and he figures out it's because she has been giving him all of her food. She cannot fucking stand him at this point. And she's like, yeah, but he's, I need to feed him. He's in my care. And it's like, honestly, like this wrenching moment where this had even been hidden from us as the readers, like, yeah, just right. Like how fully committed she is in every way to helping slaves stay free, to helping enslaved people free themselves and stay that way. And yes, it's just so like, it's such a telling little detail, but I just thought it was really, I thought it was beautiful. Like I did. Yeah.
Because it's rare in any book to find a character who is so, has such courage and also has such like purity of heart.
Yes.
Like there's a sort of, there's nothing selfish about Hester, and somehow she's not intolerable. Do you know what
right,
I mean?
Like, absolutely. Yeah.
The like purely selfless characters in literature usually are a little bit boring.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not the case here, even a little.
Because she has her pride, because she has her dignity. You know, the story of her and her childhood friend not knowing what it would mean to have indigo stained hands. I mean,
oh my God, that story is so beautiful, in large part because it's such an honest way of looking at children too.
Yeah.
Like, again, I don't think I'd had that. I mean, I have a 6-year-old, right? And so I think like I haven't read this since I've had like a person in my house who is young and like has thoughts like this. But Bev harnesses that sort of the sense of like the girls working with the dye, right?
Yeah.
And looking at them and sort of talking about how they can't wait until their hands are blue like their mothers or like the women around them. Like that will be a symbol of them being big, like grown up.
Yeah.
And when they articulate it, the sort of awareness that they have that what they had thought would be a badge of honor is actually one of shame.
Yeah.
And there's this, it's palpable and it's gut-wrenching. I mean, it's remarkable. She does remarkable. I mean, it's just incredible work.
Yeah.
Because she
really is. Yeah.
You know, we talked, it shows also that, like, I mean, she is a queen of the genre. Because there aren't many writers who are able to tackle issues this massive and be
with
able,
such a light touch.
I mean, and I think this is a conversation, not to derail us like away from the book too much, but I think this is a conversation that's happening a lot in romance right now, is like, how can we tell these powerful stories about institutional wrongs? There was a thread from Adriana Herrera the other day about how she really was, she was looking for more white writers to write historicals about white women aware of their complicity in these kind of problematic and structurally incredibly damaging systems, colonization and slavery, et cetera. And I, you know, my instinct when I looked at it was like, how do you tell that story and retain the fantasy, right? Retain the, what we call, what you and I talk about as the id, right? That sort of like, that powerful stickiness.
Yeah.
Bev doesn't have a problem doing it, but she's also the best.
Yeah. Well, and you know what, though? I think what it really speaks to, and I think this is what Adriana's books do so well, too, and I talked about American Love Story last night at this bookstore as one of the best romances of the year for this reason, is when you are in love with someone who shares a powerful vision of what the world should be like.
Yes.
Then you and your lover are going to work tirelessly towards making that dream a reality.
Yes.
And this is something that I think this book is just does really well. And, you know, there's so many things I feel like I could talk about this book probably forever, but I mean, so basically he leaves and it's months before she sees him again. And, you know, and he says, next time you see me, you're going to have to pretend you don't know me. One of the things I find really fascinating about this book is, even though he is, again, like sort of in some ways types to a very like strong, kind of possessive, he loves her and wants her kind of male, never once does he say to her, you shouldn't be doing, like, when you're my wife, you're gonna like stop all this. And it's not that I really expected that he would, but it must have been a worry, because I remember there's a really powerful scene where they save a local woman, mm-hmm. right? Hester essentially impersonates her. They go in and they sort of dress her in Hester clothes and send the woman out to freedom. And then, you know, Hester's like sitting in the jail cell. And this is a remarkably like dangerous moment for her in the book, where she's really put herself in danger. And never once is she, Galen's response to say, you shouldn't have done that. He was worried about her, of course, but he knew full well that he respected it.
Well, it's also this awareness of these two characters. It is similar to Adriana's book in the sense that it's this awareness that like these characters understand that they are servants to a higher power.
Yeah.
Like there's their job. They are not like, happily ever after for them is not only like living in happiness with their love. It's the end of slavery. It's the like there are larger movements in this book, and there are larger movements in these people's lives. But I feel like Bev is writing that small moment in this with this awareness that like it's just one seed.
They have bigger things to accomplish, and now they will be able to do it with someone who shares that same goal and purpose. And it's beautifully done. And they both have really interesting backstories. I mean, even Galen's backstory. I mean, God, when you think she essentially has an entire plot about colorism, about light-skinned slaves and how they treat people, and Hester's fear that she will not be treated the same because she's darker.
Royalty in his community, like as Galen, not Black Daniel.
Yes. They don't know that about him, which is, you know, he's like a literal superhero. No,
and can we also talk about, again, how within the context of romance, romance at the time, she's still writing, you know, she's doing all this and she's basically like, hold my beer, everyone. Like, because she's still writing. She's writing all these huge, like, movements, like cultural, social movements, historical movements. She's tackling an institution of oppression that no one else, like, we read Gentle Rogue. They're running slaves and, like, no one says anything. No one else is even whispering about. And then on top of it, she's still writing this, like, core alpha. Like, he does not understand feelings.
Oh my God, you guys, like the part where she like finds him in his carriage and he's newly upholstered at all in indigo velvet, but I was like, he loves you.
He's like, why? I just like blue.
It's like, honestly, I mean, I was just like, I'm gonna have to take to my bed for like hours after that, because he's like, I'm not sure I'm in love with her. And I was like, yes you are.
Of course you are, you dummy. And I just, it's so, like, but she's writing this kind of, like, real, he's so, like, rough and gorgeous. Ugh. And, like, he's so delicious. And he's also a king, right? Yeah, we talk about it all the time. Like, he's a king. Sure. And he would be a king even if he weren't a king in Louisiana. Yeah. He would be a king by virtue of the work that he does, right? Like, yes, he's a king. Right.
And that's what makes him so powerful. It's not just that he's a king by his birthright, but by his actions,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, born and made. Yeah.
Right, both. Both, yeah.
I also think, I mean, Bev also writes, she writes contemporaries that are sort of edge into inspirational. They're sort of on the line.
Yeah.
And those are that's the Blessings series. And And so when she does things like talks about the fact that he's given the name the Black Daniel because of biblical Daniel, the, you know, Daniel right. in the lion's den, like these are choices that are made intentionally. When she, when Bev makes a biblical reference, she yeah. knows, again, it's like Sierra Simone. She knows what she's doing.
I think the part that was also really fascinating about that, though, is it's such a pragmatic, like faith, right? That they both have.
Of course.
And in particular, there's a scene where like, and we're going to talk about sex because woo.
Oh boy.
Where Hester goes to a, like an older woman and is like, okay, look, I've got a lot of questions and I need you to answer them for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it is clear, it's not a long scene. It's probably a couple sentences that this woman is like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to answer all these questions for you. And so even though there are definitely like social mores that like govern her existence, she does not feel like bound by them. Like, right. She feels like there are going to be choices she gets to make for herself and that's going to totally be okay. And that is, I think, like well within the realm of her like faith and her belief in God. I mean, it's really powerfully done.
Yes. It's just, it's a huge book. It's a big book.
Yeah.
It's a big book that's doing something on every page. You know, I also wanted, before we start talking about sex, I want to talk about Galen a little more because I think Beth is making some really interesting choices here. So she sort of established this king man, right?
Yeah.
Who is, who like, well, first of all, this is basically friends to lovers, this story. They love it. They care. Like, yeah. Obviously, Beverly Jenkins has never written like a couple who isn't like at each other's throats a little bit. But like they're at each other's throats. And nobody writes like verbal sparring between two people who love each other like Bev. Like it feels like marriage before it, in the sense that like it's two people who like each other and or also sort of get on each other's nerves at the beginning. And they're always like her heroines always talk back. Like, they always have a quick response. They don't take any shit. It's great.
It's great.
Yeah. Like, would that we were all
a
Beverly Jenkins heroine. But then also what she's doing here is she's making really interesting choices because, like I said, it's an adventure novel and we have all this stuff happening kind of outside in the world. Like at one point, right at the end, it's maybe two-thirds the way through, and Galen has to leave because there's a child who needs to be kidnapped, right?
Right.
And so they're married. They're like, they're now
it's
they're
right
like,
after they get married.
Yeah, they
right?
get married. Yeah. They're like living together, right? And so like everything's like she's sort of installed in his house and, you know, kind of marveling at this world that he lives in.
Right.
And then he's like, I gotta go because I gotta kidnap this kid who's been left behind.
Yeah.
And she's like, okay, well, be careful. And he leaves. And in my head, I was like, this is one of those moments where authorial choice is really interesting. And I sort of couldn't stop thinking about, we don't go with him.
No,
right?
Not at all.
We're never, and that's when I realized, and I think this was the first read where I really realized that, we never go with him, right?
Nope.
Like, he goes off and does whatever he's doing. And like, that's an interesting story. Whatever's happening with him is something interesting, right? Like, he's going to go kidnap a kid.
Right.
And, like, fight. Whatever.
Right. Whereas when Hester does what she does, we are with her. Right?
We are
like,
with
the scene at the jail.
We're
with her. Right. Exactly.
But what's interesting is I think this is a Beverly Jenkins core story, you know, for lack of a better word to describe it. I think Bev is really interested in women and women's work and women's work in service of this higher power.
Yep, absolutely.
And I don't know because I'm not Bev, but it feels to me like making the choice to stay with Hester and have Hester sort of experience what she's, because then while he's away, there's like, you know, stuff happens, like people come to the house. There are fugitive slaves who return, who are at the house. There's the shoe, the miserable, awful, like atrocious slave hunter coming. Like, there's lots going on.
Yeah.
And then Galen returns when we get to sex, I'm going to talk about that return scene. But anyway, but the point is, like, she could be telling a story. She could have bitten off more than she could chew there, right? Like, yeah, that leaving with Galen would have been a choice that a lot of authors would have made.
Right.
And suddenly you're telling complete, you're off on a tangent and you can't get yourself back.
Yeah.
But right. Hester and women in Bev's stories are the doers. They're lodestars, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I think that part's really interesting because in that way, I mean, Galen's a great character. I mean, it does have some of the hallmarks as we've been reading some of these 90s books, right? Where it's like within a chapter, we're switching back and forth, like paragraph by paragraph or sentence by sentence into one or the other's point of view, right? Like, so we're sort of seeing like that as being, you know, that technique being used. But for the most part, it is Hester herself that is really the, as you said, like the star of this, and also the one who, she is growing in so many ways in this book. It's like, you know, she always knew who she was as like a conductor on the railroad, right? As a person in the town, but like who she is as a woman and who she is as someone who has her own like desires and needs, both like sort of curiosity wise. I mean, you know, we really get the sense that she like and Galen love talking to each other, that they
they adore each other.
Right. And that she was, you know, when he says you are going to give yourself up to this like passionless marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is like she just didn't realize because I think she'd seen her aunt sort of quietly never getting involved with this man she was in love with her whole life, right? Mm-hmm. There was a sense that this could be like a happy life for her, and she wouldn't have been miserable, but that with Galen it's just blowing the doors off into a different reality.
Well, this is the thing, right? Like, I think what Bev is saying in this and in so many of her other books, she's saying women are central. The women's lives don't exist in service of men.
Yeah.
They exist to be and work and do at a larger level. But with the right man, they can really have it all. And you know what? I want to have it all. And like, and this is the thing. I think that Beverly Jenkins with Indigo and all of her other books, but especially in the 90s, Beverly, Lisa Kleypas, and some other people in historicals were writing heroines who worked.
Yeah.
Who had jobs or purpose, and they were people who would be fine on their own.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's something really powerful. I think that also like tackled for, you know, 15-year-old me when I read this book for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that really felt like something important.
Yeah, it is important. It's still important. And I think that's the part about the book that I really, that she never loses her purpose. Can we talk a little bit about her like ex-fiance and the, you know, the woman who ends up being like kind of no good, like the end of the plot? It's really interesting.
It's plotty.
I don't think it's bad. I think you need a little bit of plot.
No,
I think,
remember we were talking the other day, we were talking about Sierra and you were saying like at the end, there's this like external thing and it like comes in to tie everything up and you didn't love it. And I think, and I said then, it's hard to tie it all up emotionally. Like, you need a inflection point.
Yeah.
And sometimes plot is where that comes from.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's really interesting about this is this sense of, this being like a foil in some ways, but like this like negative one where when you make the right choice and you meet the person who you have a – like a shared, like she and Galen have a shared purpose, a common purpose that makes both of them better. But her ex, I can't remember his name, Mr. Terrible, and his new wife are the opposite, right? He thought he found someone who really cared about him the same way, but instead she was working at cross purposes with him, and he didn't even realize that. And she like steers him wrong. And I don't think I don't want to excuse like sort of that, his terribleness to her, but I thought it was just like a really interesting commentary. And, you know, frankly, in our lives, I'm sure we've had that where, you know, I say that to people all the time. I'm like, the reason I think Daryl is like a great husband for me is I can easily and list the 800 ways he's made me stronger and better. And the people who I sort of worry about are the people whose marriages make them worse, more divisive, more petty, like sure. harder.
Yeah.
And I think that that in that way, that pairing, it doesn't really it worked for me at like that level, right? Like I didn't actually have a problem with it all coming in because I was like, it's showing me something really important about what happens when you pick the right person versus when you pick the wrong person.
Yeah. So. And I think, again, it's about, I mean, what Bev's books teach readers, women, is, you know, you don't compromise on that. Like there's the gray moment where she says, I'm not marrying you. And he's like, no, yeah, you are. And she's basically like, you're a king. Why would you marry me?
Why would you marry me? Yeah.
And he's like, well, certainly not for your obedience. Right. Like, and there's just these moments where they're perfect little sparkling jewels of these two people who are just right for each other. Like at the end of this book, you feel a deep satisfaction that the stars are in line and like everything is gonna be okay.
And I want to buy it for like everyone I know. It's one of those books.
Yeah. Well, because also let's not forget the fact that like it works for readers in and out of the genre because of, you know, interestingly, 2 weeks ago we talked about Lord of Scoundrels, right? And and I said it works for readers in and out of the genre. This works for readers in and out of the genre in a different way, right? Like, this is a rollicking good story in and out of the genre.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just say one more thing about sort of that external conflict part. At the end, you know, it's inevitable that Hester is going to really have this run-in with Shu, this terrible slave catcher.
I mean, she puts the gun on the table chapter one.
At the very beginning. Like, we knew it was going to happen. But you know what I really ended up liking about this scene is that it's like an emotional journey. Like Hester never doubts for a second that Galen is going to come and find her and get her. And it really worked for me to not have it be like sort of a big, right? Like the payoff of that moment is emotional rather than like, again, like it's like the adventure part gets like pushed down so that the emotional weight of the scene, the emotional weight of this journey and of her, you know, of Hester really knowing, like never having any doubt, that is the part that's like just really emotionally rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I also want to, this is sort of a little extra satellite thing that I want to just make sure I say, is Jeanette, the character who Galen was supposed to marry, the kind as children they had been betrothed.
Yes.
You know, it was one of those moments where, again, you sort of see how Bev is on a different path than other writers. Like, everyone and their mother was writing in the 90s, like, the evil other woman who, like, is bitter and mean.
Oh, yeah.
And Jeanette is not that. Jeanette is
not
like,
at all.
You know what? He would have hated being married to me, and it would have made our relationship terrible, and I like him too much, and I'm so glad you're together. And that's really great.
It was really great.
Can we talk about how hot this book is?
Okay.
I mean, what? I sort of like, I guess I had sort of forgot. I don't know if I'd forgot. I mean, I couldn't have possibly forgotten it. I've read it 1,000 times. But like this time on the reread, I was like, they do it a lot.
And can I just say this man is a fucking hero to all of Romancelandia. He makes her, like, they have sex at least 3 or 4 times where he is just getting her off.
Yep. This is for you. He says it at one point.
This is for you. And I was like, sir, thank you.
Thank you for your service. The Medal of Romance.
And you know what's great about it is she doesn't, and of course, because she's so innocent, she doesn't even know Yeah. Right? Like, we as readers are like, ooh, this man is, but there's none of that. Like, he is just really all there for her. And it is super hot. I mean, God, you guys, if you're into carriage sex, that indigo velvet gets a workout, right?
Yep.
And he's like, I've been waiting for this. And I was
I mean, there's a whole lot of oral in this book. And it's like on the page, it's not like early 90s oral where like you're sort of picking through the like, the euphemisms to figure out what the hell's going on. Like, it's straight up oral. I'm for it.
It is. It was amazing. And you know what else? So, and this is what I wanted to say. There's like a scene, and I think it's the same, the scene in the bath.
Yeah. Oh, except that bath scene. He's so gross. Okay. Get out of there. I'm like, they're both in this dirty water. Get out of it.
He took a pre-bath and then the bath. Like, it was all, I felt fine with it. You know, here's the thing I was thinking about a lot, though, which is, it's also a real, I mean, yeah, it's hot, okay? And I'm all for that. We all know. But it's also a real masterclass in how good sex scenes are about intimacy, mm-hmm. not just physical pleasure.
Yes.
And the way in which it is clear that they are like that, I don't know. It's just really beautiful. I mean, and it just, it's going to sound goofy, but like, you know, there's a part where he like, just like reaches in and touches her, and it's not like, cause he wants to like get her off. It's cause he loves her the way she feels, how beautiful she is, her skin, her, like, you know, like the, her person, right? Her body. And it's just so like, it's both sexy, but it's intimate and it's sensual. And I feel like there's nothing as sexy as it is. And as much as they are doing it, it is never, it's never mechanical.
No. So weirdly, we were supposed to record this episode yesterday, and I had a very limited window of time to record, and my phone rang like 30 seconds before we started recording, and it was Bev on the phone.
And I was like, talk to her.
Was real weird. I was like, why is Beverly Jenkins calling me? Is my house wired? And we talked for a second, and then I was like, Bev, your ears must have been ringing. I'm about to do a podcast about Indigo. And then I said, like, is there anything you want to say? Yeah. And she was like, I just want to tell everybody. She's like, you know, she's heard me talk about Indigo before. She knows it's one of my favorite books. And she was like, no, I don't. And then she goes, you know, just tell everybody it's still one of my favorites. And it spawned the Detroit series because all of Hester and Galen's children have books. So heads up, everyone, you can go read those and we'll put them in show notes. And then I was like, well, can we talk about the fact that it's real hot? And she was like, I was like, Beverly Jenkins. And she laughed. And if you've never heard Bev laugh, like, it's this smoky, like, it's this beautiful, wonderful laugh. And she laughed and she was like, well, you know, that's how we did it in those days. And I laughed and I was like, I couldn't believe how many times they do it. And she was like, Sarah, back then, if you didn't have 10-page sex scenes, you weren't doing it right. And I was like, all right.
Take note, everybody. Because
I mean, they do it. Yeah. It's so funny because now people are like, if I have more than 4 sex scenes, like, is it erotica? I'm like, Hester and Galen do it like 83 times in this book.
Yeah, they do.
Hey, can we also talk about, it's sort of like a weird left turn off sex, but
no, it's okay.
I mean, but it's lady parts. There's a moment where she talks about her period with him.
Yes.
And I now wish that we talked about this during the bodily autonomy episode.
Yeah.
Because it's really awesome. Like, she's like,
yes, it is.
I'm having my period. And he's like, cool. And in her mind, right. She's like, wives would never talk about this, but there's this play of like, I want you to be my wife and my mistress.
Yes.
Right. Through the whole, and I love, it's such a like sexy through line.
Yes.
Between them. But, and she's like, but a mistress probably would say something. So I'm going to say it. And she says it and he's taken aback too, but he's like, all right, I'm going to roll with this. Yeah. And there's this wonderful, it's awesome. And it's really interesting because it marries itself with, at the beginning, when he's first unconscious in her house.
Right.
He wakes up and she's like, there, and he basically says, like, where can I pee?
Yes.
And she's like, well, there's a chamber pot in the corner. And he's basically like, I'm not doing that
in front of you. Yeah.
And And like, there's a play on like, oh, well, maybe it's because he doesn't, because his penis is too big or something. But it's really, but like, you get the sense that like, no, it's actually that he's on, he doesn't want to pee.
Yeah, he's uncomfortable. Right.
And so like, there's this sense of like their bodies being like this kind of cute, at the beginning, this kind of like awkward, like fear of showing too much of yourself or like showing a side of yourself that like might be less attractive. And then like by the time we get to like saying like I have my period, like my God, I don't always say to my husband like, oh, yes, I have my period. Like it's a real intimate
thing, of course, right?
To talk about that. It.
The trust that she has in him in every way. I mean, like the part where like, you know, it's like there's this really delicious moment earlier in the book where he's still there, right? And she shows him all of the like secret passageways in her house.
Yeah.
And it's like throughout the whole book, it's them showing each other.
Well, yeah, it's like, and this sense of like the unpeeling of their personalities at one point, and Jeanette sort of puts a button on it at the end when she says to Hester, like, do you know where he goes when he goes away?
Yeah.
And Hester obviously doesn't say anything. She doesn't give it up. But it's clear to Jeanette that she does.
Yes. Know.
And she says, like, that's how I know he's right for you and not right for me.
Yeah.
That he trusts you enough to show you. And, I mean, it's just really powerful. I mean, and I think I kept thinking while I was reading it that, you know, relationships are so much about, we've talked about this before, there's so much about power and there's so much about trust and about communication, and like it's so hard. It's work every day of a relationship to like do that right and like do that with respect and thought and care and love. And it's just so right here.
Yeah,
it's like this is a marriage that like it's a textbook marriage.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's really
what
beautiful.
You should want your marriage to be.
There's this one part, and I want to talk about one of the things I really also loved about the book is how even after they're married and they're happy, the threats from outside, those external threats, because they still live in a time when slavery is legal, and they still live in a time where despite their paperwork, one of them could be captured and sold into slavery. Something that I think people don't realize happened all the time, right? Like Robert E. Lee's army, when they came up to Gettysburg, like took free black people and sent them back south to slavery. And so this idea that they were never, you know, despite this is really, it's always this like really, it's part of their romance. It's not anything that's ever washed away. And there's this really beautiful part where he basically says to her, you know, he's like, look, you know, you're my wife and, you know, we're married now and I'm not going to have, you know, I'm not going to let anything happen to you. And she says to him, sometimes promises made by people like you and me are nearly impossible to keep. And it's this beautiful moment where he is like, yeah, but we're going to, if that's the case, then we're going to run together. And I'm ready for that if you are. And it means that we're probably going to have to kill him. You know what I mean? We're going to, that might be what it means. And instead of her kind of being like, oh, I don't know about that or whatever, right? She's like, I hope not, but maybe it is. And there's this sense of, this just being like, now that they have each other, the cost on them is going to be shared, right? I don't know. Like,
yeah, it's burden sharing.
The burden sharing. And they like they hold each other. And I guess I should tell you what it's. And to me, it's like really one of the it's the end of chapter 20 that this scene happens. And I think it's why to me, it's like the power of this book is just in its insistence that, and we talk about this a lot for women, right? But, you know, for black characters at this time, for anybody who, and we talk about this about romance, for anyone who is marginalized, right? To question their ability to just like have a happily ever after, this is the scene where it's like, well, have you read Indigo? Because here are people who know what's promised happiness, but if you are together and you, despite what the world might do to you, you will have this sense of like, we're in this together, right? We're fighting together. And I don't know. I just think that it really spoke to me. I don't know. It just was really beautiful. Like, this book is really pretty perfect.
Well, because it does what we've been saying all season, what we've been saying for two seasons and for longer. Like, it does that work of telling a story within a story about a life and a time and a world that still exists in its weird way. And it does such important work, capital W. And it's one, I mean, there are a handful of books that I can point to that I sort of think, I feel are important books.
Yeah.
And this is one of them. You know, like, there are a lot of romance novels that I adore, but there are many, many fewer that I find important, that I wish I could hand to everybody and say, like, this is the work romance can do.
Absolutely.
You know. Yeah, it's magnificent. So I want to talk, I want to do a couple things. One, I want to say Bev's future books. I mean, what do you want to talk about Forbidden?
Oh,
your favorite?
Forbidden is my favorite, yeah.
Forbidden was going to be on Jen's list, but I made her read Indigo. So that you know, if the list included any book that was not, that the other person hadn't read, made the list.
Right, exactly. Forbidden is, you know what? It's really interesting, and I was thinking about this. I cannot remember this, like, movie, but I remember as a kid, like, before I read romance, like, maybe not middle schoolish, watching a movie about a woman who was passing and finding it just, like, fascinating. Like, really, like, being like, wait, why would you have to do that? Like, I was, you know, I also grew up in a town that was, like, all white people and just really segregated. And, you know, I had no idea what was going on. And I just remember, like, really feeling, like, at that moment that there were, like, the magnitude of all the things I did not know and understand. And, you know, and I think that Forbidden is part of her most recent kind of complete series. I think it's called the Old West series. And it's the first book about a woman who essentially heads out west and, you know, she is going to, you know, kind of find her destiny, like, similar issues. And she falls in love with a man who she thinks is a white man in the town. And he is so into her. And she's like, why would I want to get with this white man? Like, essentially. And you know, she's like, I'm not going to do that. That's not who I am. And it turns out he's passing. And the thing about the book that I thought was really so well done is it shows, like, people pass for, like, reasons, right? But there's also a price for what they leave behind in the community, like the Black community that like would love and nurture them. And it's a really fascinating book. And I really loved, like, it's probably, I don't know if now I'm like, well, now there's competition, but it had been my favorite Beverly Jenkins book before. And I just think it's ride the Beverly Jenkins train. You're going to get on and not want to get right back off.
It's
right.
It's true. It's true. Forbidden is, now has been optioned by Sony Pictures.
That's right.
For a television show. So, yay for that. More romance on film. Beverly Jenkins on film. Bev also has a movie that everybody can watch. We'll put links in the show notes. What's it called? Deadly Sexy.
Yeah, one of her contemporaries.
She writes romantic suspense. She writes a lot, man. She writes romantic suspense. She writes historical. She writes these kind of contemporary, small town, almost inspirationals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's amazing. So I wanted to talk about that. And then, I had another thing.
I mean, I just think when you read a book like this, it's just, like, hard to even say, like, what's so great about it is just amazing. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I made you read it.
I'm glad you made me read it, too.
I remember the first time I ever met Bev, I was at the Atlanta RWA, and I got out of a car, and I was a baby. It was maybe my second or third RWA, and I got out of the car, and I was walking into the hotel, and I saw this woman standing, like, to the side of a door, and she was all alone, and I looked at her, and I was like, are you Beverly Jenkins? And she was like, I did that thing that people do at RWA. Right. And she was so kind. And I was like, oh, my God, I love your book so much. And Indigo and Hester. And she was, I like blathered into her face. And then since then, we've become friendly because I have such, as you all know, such a like fascination with the history of the genre. And
oh, yeah. She must be a treasure trove of historical knowledge. Like, yeah.
Cornerstone. Like she's able to, she has been so, when we worked on the Rita ceremony, she was so amazingly helpful in getting, in sort of helping us set straight the timeline because,
yeah, I'm sure.
You know, but what's fascinating, and this is something that I wanted to say that I think is important to say within the context of how did I come to Bev? You know, there were a lot of other Black writers writing at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there was Sandra Kitt and Brenda Jackson, and Elsie Washington had sort of started at Harlequin in the 80s. And, you know, Vivian Stevens had edited that sort of first class of Harlequins. And we don't talk about those early authors as much as we should.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and it's really interesting. I've seen Miss Bev talked quite a few times, and one of my favorites was I went down and saw her at a library that's, I live on the south side of Chicago, but it was like further south than me at like a big regional library center. And, you know, it was like sort of all, a lot of her fans, people who clearly, like, it was great. At one point, Bev was like, you know, the book where blah, blah, blah. And someone like shouts out the name for her, right? She was like, I don't remember. But, you know, it was really clear to me at that point that, you know, she had both a really like warm and friendly and like convivial relationship with her readers who like obviously love and adore her books, but also that she talks every time I've seen her, she talks about who came before her.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really it's just great to like read this book and see someone who really loves romance and loves the genre and has like, I mean, I'm reading this book many, many years after you and still was like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's really, you guys, it's a great read. If you're looking for something over the holidays,
yeah,
this is the read. I mean, it's just so fun and sexy and emotional and also, like, I feel like we spend so much of this episode talking about like serious stuff.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
But this book is so fun.
I mean, and like the banter's really funny. And at one point they're at a funeral and they're sort of like speaking ill of the dead, but in a way that's like really funny. And like a joke gets made about like someone turning in their grave that had me literally laughing out loud. And I think that that's the part, like it's like that the it's like snappy where it needs to be snappy and tight where it needs to be tight and tender where it needs to be tender. And, you know, like, yeah, thinking about this as being someone's an early book by someone, right? Yeah. It's just shocking that it's like so amazingly perfect.
Yeah. All right. What's next, Jen? Okay. So wait, so this is coming out. This is coming out. We've got an interstitial next week.
Oh, no, which, it's like the AMA, another AMA part two, I think.
Wait, is that next week that we're not doing our special Pegging Cabal episode next week?
Yeah, we still have to re-record it, though.
All right.
Well, what's day is it, right? It's going to be like the 10th?
This is going to be the 10th, and then it'll be the 17th.
The 17th is the second AMA. The week after is Christmas.
So it's Christmas, so we're going to have a short episode on Christmas. It'll be 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
Both of it is for real 10 minutes long. We're going to recommend a couple of quick holiday romances for you
and
to tide you through New Year's.
January 1st, New Year's, will be Born in Ice by Nora Roberts, which
the
is
queen herself.
Yes, a book that blooded me. And then the Pegging Cabal will get their interstitial in early January.
Yes, that's we promise. We know we recorded a whole one. We had some problems. We're recording it again. It's exciting.
It is.
Here's a fun thing that happened last week. We posted last week the call at the end of the podcast was cut off for some of you. We're gonna put it in at the end of this episode too. It's worth listening all the way through because it's hilarious. But holiday PSA: don't call us while you're driving. But you should call us. If you want to tell us about the book that blooded you, you can call us at 646-450-3766. And that's the only place you'll actually get that telephone number.
That's right. You can buy swag from my best friend Kelly at my shop at jenreadsromance.com. And then Sarah has an amazing line of t-shirts and other swag from a Brooklyn artist named Jordan
Dene.
Jordan Dene. Okay.
And Jordan, you will find Jordan. We'll put links in. And there are two shirts, two things available now, many more to come. Hopefully a Fated Mate shirt to come in the new year.
Fun. All right. Have a great week, everybody. And we'll see you next time on Fated Mates.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Molly. I think my Twitter handle is at Molly Weave, or Weave Nuts. We've talked about stuff like this before. So it's funny, as soon as you guys put up the voicemail, I was really excited, and I was trying to think of, like, what books that I haven't read in a really, really, really long time that I just, I have, like, 1,500 books on my Kindle, and that's not including the thousands that are probably buried in my parents' house somewhere. Like, what are the titles of some that I can think of almost immediately out of that? And the first one, which is funny because you immediately started talking about the Bridgertons after that, was, I think it's called When He Was Wicked, obviously by Julia Quinn, and it's Michael Sterling is the guy, and Francesca, who was married to his brother, which is, you know, interesting, but for whatever reason, I wouldn't call him the cinnamon roll, but I think that there's a lot of cinnamon roll qualities there. Like, he's been in love with her for years and years and years and wanted to give himself away because obviously she was married to his brother. I just have this recollection of it being just really wonderful and a little bit more risque, I guess, maybe, than the rest of the Bridgerton books because she's marrying her dead husband's brother. So anyway. Another one is a really old, I think it's Susan Elizabeth Phillips, I'm not sure, I'll have to look at them, maybe I'll call back and tell you, but it's called Truly Madly Yours. I couldn't tell you why, I really haven't read it in years, I'm actually, woo! Hi, this is Molly Weeves, or Molly again. I'm okay, I was calling while I was driving and there was a brick in the road that I didn't see because I was on the phone. Anyways, I just wanted to say thank you guys, and I really enjoyed this podcast.